The Buddha said, "One thing and one thing alone I lay down, dukkha and the ceasing of dukkha, the deliverance from dukkha." Dukkha is translated as ill, the ill state. And the ill state, as presented by Buddha Gosha in his Path of Purity, the Visuddhimagga, is the state which is the void or the infinite, the non-finite, in a spoilt condition. Du meaning bad, contemptible, spoilt, and khan meaning the infinite. Now, all that takes place in our life in the ill state is known as samsara. It is called the cycle of births and deaths in the English language. Samsara. But the real meaning of samsara is the cycle of births and deaths, of uprisings and ceasings in the mind, in consciousness. It has no relationship, in fact, despite the popular belief held for 25 centuries and more, with the idea that one is reborn bodily after the death of this body. This cycle of births and deaths takes place in one's own mind. And it is also distinctly taught by the Buddha that mind and body completely interdepend upon each other. There is no carrying over afterwards. I know I am regarded as a heretic presenting this truth. But that is always the case. It's more often than not the heresy which is nearer the truth than the popular orthodox doctrine and belief. Do realize that. Now this samsara is the cycle of births and deaths in one's own mind, one's own consciousness. And it is this which causes us joy, sorrow. Because attachment, aversion gets associated with whatsoever we like and dislike. This produces the state of conflict. Furthermore, we identify what we are pleased to call myself with this passing process of daily events, states of mind, moods, desires and the pursuit of desires and our activities and so forth. And since all this uprises and deceases in the mind, we say that one is born with the uprising of the particular state of mind or consciousness, and one dies with the deceasing, the ending of that state of consciousness. And because we are tied by the bonds of desire to this, that or the other, and equally tied by perhaps the more terrible bond of aversion to this, that and the other, and we can never avoid that for which we have an aversion, it will somehow or other come into our life, we are in sorrow. We must distinguish clearly the ill state in which we are as a matter of fact, of complete fact, and the personal sorrow, which is a psychical response or reaction to the event. And the extraordinary thing is that both pleasure and pain finally lead to sorrow, because pleasure and pain both belong to that limited realm of duality which is responsible for conflict, for frustration or a short temporal success. Now, get this quite clearly in your mind, so that what happens in the course of our life in this ignorant state, this state of conflict, is that the mind is continuously fluctuating. Now, we'll look into the Upanishads further back before the time of the Buddha and what they taught and how they taught it. Just as the actions of people cease with the stopping of the fluctuations of the sun, meaning sunrise, sunset, and all the rest of it, you see. So, when the fluctuations of the mind cease, this cycle of births and deaths, samsara, comes to an end. This is from the Shandilya Upanishad, absolutely clearly stated that when the fluctuations of the mind cease, the whole cycle of births and deaths has come to an end. In other words, we are conscious of existence in a new mode. It's a new dimension of being and consciousness which comes to birth. This is the rebirth, the second birth, as it is called, which you find in practically all religious teachings. This is the second birth, the awakening to the reality which is present for us in our ignorant state. The births and deaths that go on from day to day, from year to year, even from moment to moment. But they concern you or me in your or my life just here. And because, as the Buddha particularly affirmed very, very clearly, the mind and body completely interdepend, they come into existence as a complete psychophysical whole, and when that living person is dead, the whole of that psychophysicality is completely disintegrated. Nothing goes on which can be labeled with my name or with my consciousness or any such thing. Now, we can discuss that far more in detail on some other occasion. I just want to use that as an introduction for what we'll consider now. In the Maitri Upanishad, it is distinctly stated, samsara is just one's own thought process. The cycle of births and deaths is just one's own thought process, nothing else. So, it is this understanding of the mind, the nature of the mind, and bringing the mind, or letting the mind, grow into the state of peace and health, which is the problem of all and the task associated with all religious discipline. Now, when that state of health of the mind, that harmony of the mind, that dynamic poise and peace is realized in us ourselves, then one has, in Upanishadic terminology, realized the Atma, or become Brahman. And this is what the Varaha Upanishad says with regard to that. That which is consciousness alone, which is all-pervading, which is eternal, which is all full, which is of the form of bliss, and which is indestructible, is the only true Brahman. Brahman and Atma are completely interchangeable terms, right through the Upanishads. Brahman and Atma are identical. So you see, when you yourself, purified, harmonized, in the state of perfect peace, inward peace, whatever the external situation may be, are totally unresisting to the free flow of life, and the play, and the whole play of the becoming process, as it flows past and in and through you, that state is the state which can be named Atma or Brahman. This has nothing to do with words like self, or the supreme self, or super self, or God, or the absolute, or any such thing. When this happens through you, the individual, then the name Atma, the word Brahman, has its complete and full meaning as an actual fact, and that fact is realized transcendence through you. If you don't understand this really clearly, all the religious teachings are just talk. Meaningless talk. The kingdom of heaven, nirvana, a paradise, the paradise of the Muslims, the Garodemana of the Zarathustrians, all becomes just sheer nonsense. Just words, meaningless words. And we spin out all kinds of images about them, which have no reality, no substance to them. It's very important to get at this fundamental. Now, the Buddha had his phrase. He didn't use a single word, but he had a whole phrase, which was the exact equivalent of Atma or Brahman as portrayed in this Varaha Upanishad. And that phrase is Vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato pabam. Consciousness, vijnana, consciousness, anidasanam, without any characteristics, infinite, non-dimensional, immeasurable therefore. What we might like to call the absolute, or any other sound we may like to make in the English language. Anidasanam, anantam, endless. Words like immortality, eternity, are associated with anantam, sabbato, everywhere. Pabham or pahang. The one word is used in the long discourses, the other word is used in the middle-length discourses, meaning shining or accessible. Now, you see, the Buddha also says the same thing. If one takes the trouble really to go into the depths and understand what was the actual teaching of the great ones. You may call it Atma or Brahman, but don't think of Atma as a mysterious entity, a super entity, or Brahman or God or Eckhart's Godhead or anything at all as an other than the totality. This is the great point. Once we have understood this clearly, and understood it not merely in the sense of a pattern of words which can be as lucid as you like and satisfactory to the intellect, but in addition to that, your whole sensitivity has really grasped it. You've got it. You have eaten it, digested it, built it into your being. Eat of this, for this is my body. Drink of this, for this is my blood. Now you'll get the meaning. The whole truth is the bread and blood, or the bread and the wine. Blood and wine are interchangeable symbols in all these scriptures. See? Get hold of this, and then what you see in the scriptures as regards the way, as we call it, the process of purification, the process of meditation, and all that, it will have a totally new meaning for you, and a totally new urgency and a power involved in it. Because obviously, it is not a thing of 5 minutes or 5 hours a day or whatever it is, or going to hear XYZ give a marvelous talk. Anybody can give a marvelous talk. Even I can do that sometimes. So there is nothing marvelous in marvelous talks. Believe me, absolutely nothing. This sensitivity from within you must really open out. And it is there. It is right within you, here now. Your sensitivity hasn't got to make a journey there. You don't meet God there or realize transcendence in Japan or any such thing. Right here, wheresoever you are. In this room, in your own room, in the bath, in the lavatory, in the bus, anywhere. Transcendence is everywhere. You don't go out to it. You can't go out to it. Because it is you here and now. What are you chasing if you're going out? You see, it is like that. Now, isn't that absolutely the most heartening thing? All right. Now, let us come to this. The whole question of the discipline, as we call it, to realize this transcendent fact, which is man's destiny. This is man's destiny. That transcendence becomes self-realized, consciously. Transcendence becomes consciously self-realized through you, through me. You or I can neglect it, we can obstruct it, we can do anything like that. It doesn't matter. We merely go on the scrap heap. If I don't obstruct it, if transcendence realizes itself through me, at the death of this body, the whole thing known as Feroz Mehta goes completely into non-being, just as much the scrap heap as anybody else's. Therefore, approach religion and approach fulfillment of man's destiny utterly selflessly. There is nothing for you or me to gain in the sense that you can keep it, that you can enjoy it. Transcendence is transcendence. Meditate upon the way in which, in the Old Testament, Yahweh says again and again, after saying a few words, he says, I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. What is there for me? The word me is a little slip. Something which misfired in this particular living person. I am the Lord. When the Lord realizes itself, I'm going to say, rather than himself, through you, it is you who say, I am the Lord. Now there. So now, with regard to the discipline, and discipline means not a forcible conformity. It means learning. Who is a disciple, a discipulus? He is a learner. How do you learn? By using your brains, by using your eyes, your ears, your sense of touch, etc. Use them fully. It's a process of learning. And in order to learn, the nature of transcendence, the way of transcendence, and the way to transcendence, remember that we are constantly learning that which is everlastingly new. Now, what is the old? The old is all that has been already expressed in words, in symbols, in doctrines, in dogmas. The old is that which has been our experience, our feelings, our beliefs, our convictions, our knowledge, our memories, and so forth. All that is the old, that is the dead stuff. Don't deal with that. The becoming process will transform all that. The great galaxies, as they move in their appointed courses, sometimes move in disappointing courses, and there's an almighty explosion. Thank goodness that there is, because all that stuff is reduced to its primordiality, and the whole thing is fresh and new. Now, with the mind, the new is always that which you or I don't know. And it is this which you and I are constantly learning. Therefore, cling to nothing in the mind. Keep the mind completely open. And if the mind is left completely open, and you are totally willing to let go all the thought formulations and the word formulations, then this inward sensitivity, which is of the very essence of transcendence itself, enlightens you, illuminates you. It is the real life abundant. And in that state, you are in the state which fully expresses the meaning of the word Atma or Brahman, or the Buddha's Vijnanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbatopabam, or the kingdom of heaven, or nirvana, or any other word you like. You see, our destiny and the meaning of our being, human beings, is something absolutely marvelous. It's marvelous beyond all imagination, and certainly 10 times more so beyond all verbal expression. The real meaning of man and man's destiny. So now, if the feel of all this thrills in you, then the old words, which I have just suggested we must discard, come to life in you now, in your consciousness, in a new way. Because after all, the dictionary words remain the dictionary words, and for the sake of communication we can only use those words. But in an extraordinary manner they are everlastingly new. If I am a great concert pianist, every time I play on that piano there, which is the same old piano, as the ordinary man would say, that piano is everlastingly a new piano for me every time I play it. You see? This is a thing of the spirit. Do try and get hold of this. Really get hold of it. Or rather, let me put it the other way around. This first way is a bad way of putting it, I'm sorry. The other way around. Let it get hold of you. Let it completely permeate you and flow through you, because it is alive. Now, the Kaivalya Upanishad says, know it through faith, through devotion, through meditation and yoga. What is faith? Is it belief? Is it belief in the things which you have already discovered through your own experience, or, I think as St. Paul put it, correct me if I'm wrong, in the things which you have not seen? It is not that merely. What is faith? I'll give you a little equation. Belief empty, hyphenate the two words, belief empty equals faith full. Look, faith is a living energy, a living power within you, which perfectly, calmly, sweetly, confidently moves you forward on, I'm going to use this phrase, the right path. And the right path means your own path. You cannot tread another's path. You cannot follow in the footsteps of the master. Quite impossible. You may like to take the measurements of the footprints of the master and buy a pair of shoes or boots of the same size and pretend that you are going in the footsteps of the master. You're wasting your time. And the master, if he's a nice, kind person, will have a little chuckle inside himself. And that is all that will happen. You are a unique being. You cannot follow another's footsteps. Your life and your living process is a unique process. It bears similarities, very considerable similarities, with everybody else's life, as far as the outward pattern is concerned. But as far as the functioning and working of the living forces of life within you are concerned, they are utterly different from anybody else. You have to be yourself in that way, in that sense. Don't try to be yourself by creating a false image of yourself. Your film star, your prime minister, he's got to live up to an image. Poor devil. That's just what they do, live up to images. That is to say, they live up to death. An image is a dead thing. It's not the living you. And therefore you have lived in vain, uselessly. The life within you will release this reality of perfection, of beauty, if you let it, if you're sensible. So now, faith, it is this power which moves you on the right path, the path which is the right one for you. This is the meaning of trusting in God. You know, for instance, they say, if supposing you're riding a horse, you're a rider, and you know, when if you're a good rider and that is your horse, you and the horse are in complete tune with each other. Now, supposing you go through a forest and you have lost your way, and it's a very large forest, there comes the point when wisdom says, and all your instructors will have said, let go, let the horse find the way out. The natural wisdom of the horse will find the way out. You trust the horse. That trust, that faith, is something quite different from the kind of meaning that is the fact in the lives of most human beings, where their faith is a petty little cramped belief, a credo, whose meaning they don't know, although they mumble it day after day. So this is the faith. Now you might say, but the Buddha himself, for example, laid down faith in the Buddha. Faith in the Buddha. But surely isn't that like the worldly definition of faith? What is the meaning of faith in the Buddha? Faith in the Enlightened One. Is it to be suggested that Mr. Siddhartha Gautama, the son of his father, I should have said prince, because his father was a ruler. That Prince Siddhartha Gautama is the Buddha? That is how we know him and about him. I should say rather, that is how we know about him. Just as we know about Jesus as the Son of God, and so forth. But when you become enlightened, let me put it the other way, when enlightenment shines through you and lives in you, when what is implied in the phrase, Son of God, has come to life inside you, you are no longer Mr. John Smith or Miss Mary Brown. Do you know who you are then? You are all mankind. Not only are you all mankind, but you are the total reality, the entire universe. Potential dormant within you has sprung to life and is as fully active as possible through that organism without hurting that organism, without disrupting it, misusing it. This is the meaning of the Buddha, the Christ, the Messiah, or whatever term you use. So, faith in the Enlightened One, in that sense, is the meaning of faith in the Buddha, which is a totally different thing from having faith in a particular person whose name was Siddhartha Gautama. Quite different. In other words, your faith is not in the other person. If the Enlightened One, if the Son of God is the other person, as long as that separation lives between him, the perfected one, and me, the imperfect one, I can never have faith in him. When and how do you have faith in your husband or your wife, your brother, sister, friend, teacher, your dustman, milkman, your prime minister, or anybody? When do you have faith in him? When the otherness between you and him is out of the picture. You are in communion. You are in unity. You are in the human state, the state of purity, not the state of sin, of separation. So now faith has real meaning. That is something quite different, isn't it? You see how it involves love and wisdom, both of them in their transcendence, are there. Then there is faith. Then you are at ease always with that person. When relationships go wrong between man and wife, neither of them is at ease with the other. Isn't that so? You're always afraid, oh, that'll upset him, that'll annoy him, I better not do that. Well, where are we then? If you can't breathe the breath of life freely in the presence of the other person, this is a state of misery, of discord. All right. Enough for faith. Through devotion, one can see at once that devotion in its reality is totally devoid of attachment, of any sort of bondage. If there is no separation between that person or that activity in daily life or whatever it is, and me, myself, then I am devoted to that person or that activity. I am given to it. And I am given to it not in the sense of a commitment, which is an imposition on myself. That is not devotion, that is not love. It's not a commitment in that binding sense. It's something which is naturally there, it just can't be helped. It is so. Ask a very little child, what is a rose? And if he is a little bit of an aggressive fellow, he'll look at you quite bumptiously and say, a rose is a rose, as much as to say, you silly old fool, why do you ask such a stupid question? He's right, isn't he, really? It's like that. Devotion. If my devotion is a reaction from being frustrated in this, that and the other field, therefore I turn to this, I do so because I'm expecting a reward, a result which is pleasant to me, something which will console me, compensate me. But anything which is a reward, which is a consolation, or which is a compensation, keeps me separate, and therefore in the sinful state. Nothing to do with devotion. Through dhyana, meditation, and yoga, those are the words used. Just one word first with regard to yoga. Yoga has swept over the Western world now as a mighty wave. It's become the thing done. It's the fashion. And you look at the magazines, you know, the glossier they are, the less yogic they are. You see? Look at them all. Fit, healthy, beautiful, slimming, successful, irresistible. This is precisely how the Gadarene swine moved. And no lifeboat went out to rescue them afterwards in the sea. Something for me. No. First, get completely rid of anything for me. Then carry out any discipline you like. And this applies to everything in life. The things of daily life, going to school and learning. Don't go to school and learn and develop intellect and so forth unless you're pure. Otherwise, when you learn chemistry, you will afterwards make explosives to blow up other people and other things. You know, we never think deeply enough. We never look deeply enough into all these matters. Now, yoga, all the preliminary part, the essential preliminary part is the purification, the two great branches, yama and niyama. Then come asana, the postures, and the breathing, whose fundamental intention is that the organism shall not be obstructive to you as you pay attention to the whole of life. And it will not be obstructive to you, especially when, as the opportunity arises, you deliberately sit in meditation and go within yourself. That is the purpose of the postures and the breathing and so forth. Otherwise, woe unto you for pursuing the physical good results of postures and all the rest of it in order to beautify yourself, slim yourself and all the rest of it. Right? You beautify yourself And then because the purity is not there, the purity of the soul is not there, you will marry a devil and your whole life will be miserable. No, this is very serious. We inevitably, invariably, dig the pit of hell for ourselves when we seek anything whatsoever for ourselves. That is why I always tell people, keep away from religion. I never ask people to come to these groups. I am very happy and very willing that anybody and everybody shall come. You are free to come, but there is nothing imposed upon you. You are as free not to come as to come. You see, there is nothing to grasp, nothing to gain, so to say. One just lives according to the law of one's inner being. So, when we come, when we go anywhere, we do it out of love, which means out of purity, free of any self-motivation, self-motive I mean. Then you have done something marvelous as the blossoming of a lovely rose, which does nothing but give delight. Its perfume fills everybody. See, so much with respect to yoga. Because the latter part of the of yoga, which deals with pratyahara, which is not very well translated as withdrawal of the senses from the objects of the world, it's not quite that. It's pratyahara really means being free of attachment and aversion as one contacts the objects of the world through the senses in daily life. That's what it means. You don't indulge in foolish self-abnegations, unnecessary self-abnegations. Whatsoever is not necessary, you see that it is not necessary, it just drops off. When you really see it is not necessary, you are no longer interested in it. That's for you. Then the real pratyahara takes place. And then there is the dharana, dhyana and samadhi, the processes of the mind by which the mind completely wakes up into light, becomes totally unresisting to the inflow and the outflow of transcendent energy. And in that state you are God on earth. And in that state the real meaning of immortality is actually manifesting itself through you. So much for yoga at the moment. And we come to this thing, meditation, dhyana, paying attention. Dhyana means paying attention. If you approach meditation as a means to attain, if you have any sense, give it up. If you are intent upon the selfish approach to gain something, if you are weak enough to let the rascally mind rationalize the whole thing by saying, but I'm not doing it for my own sake, it will so help this person and that person, then be perfectly certain that you are wonderfully conceited. Who am I to help anybody whatsoever? If I live purely and simply and truly, just live, this person and that person may get helped, all right? Hurrah! Let's celebrate with a good lemonade. Very soft drink. Won't do you any harm. You see? That's all. But don't chalk it up in the tablets of memory. Ah, one good deed done, you see. You know, like the Boy Scouts, they have to do one good deed at least every day. Don't chalk it up. Because all that the Lord God will do is to say, good gracious me, who's spoiling this place with all these ugly scrolls? Don't let the mind deceive you that way, that I am doing it for the sake of others. So now, meditation. The whole thing is really quite simple. Be in the state of attentiveness. Don't fall asleep. Not just physically asleep, that is nothing. Everybody has to sleep physically. But don't fall asleep in this sense. When self-interest creeps in, I have fallen asleep. That's the meaning of being asleep. Unawake. Dumb. Dull. Stupid. When I am in the state where everything is oriented towards my own development, then I am asleep. I am not awake. The awakened one, the Buddha said he was the awakened one, the awakened one is he who is free of every limitation of self-consciousness, of isolating self-consciousness. And when you or I become capable of that freedom from all isolating self-consciousness, then there is no intrusion, obtrusion of a separate self upon the total process. And that is a blissful state. Completely blissful state. Don't associate the word bliss with the ordinary dictionary meaning of pleasurable, which implies pleasure. Or happiness, or peace. Neither you nor I know what bliss means. We constantly experience it every day of our lives when we are in dreamless slumber. As the Upanishads say, then the soul or the Atma goes back to its own. It is in its own natural, complete state. And do you know why that is so? Because in dreamless slumber, all the disturbing activities which emanate from self-consciousness directed towards advancement for the self or the so-called other person or persons, which is only a case of self-identification with them, all that is absent. Desire and conflict and duality cannot penetrate that state of dreamless slumber. But you see, that bliss is unconscious bliss. It's the bliss of Eden, the Garden of Eden, when only the man and the woman are there, and the serpent, which is the life force, hasn't yet introduced this new note in man's development. The serpent is not a deceiver, is not an enemy. The serpent is Yahweh himself in disguise. The serpent is the liberator, because unconscious bliss or perfection is not what man is intended to display. In man, the withinness has to grow. In all the other kingdoms of nature, there is no withinness. An animal can't look into himself, or a tree cannot be conscious of itself and deliberately decide to be in harmony with the universal process. And because of that, transcendent energy cannot come to self-realization consciously as it can through man. Therefore, man has to break away from that unconscious bliss and perfection and descend into the depths of difficulty, conflict, sorrow, struggle, and when the withinness has really grown to full understanding and sees and establishes its complete and true relationship with the total withoutness, then man's task is done. That is why the serpent, the life force, operates that way. I expect Christian theologians and Jewish theologians will throw brickbats at my head for saying things like this. But this is, I think, the truth of the matter. You look deeply enough into Genesis. After sufficient understanding of the Kabbalah, then you'll see what it is. So now, here the Upanishad presents the ways like this. Faith, devotion, meditation, yoga. There is just time to mention one or two other things. The Amrita Bindu Upanishad, and this same idea comes also in the greatest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka, says, having studied the books, the scriptures, well, the learned man should persevere studiously in the acquisition of jnana, or self-knowledge, and vijnana, or self-realization, according to such knowledge. This is not my translation. I wouldn't use the word self myself. The word in the original text is Atma. Then he should discard the whole of the books. As a person in quest of grain gives up the straw. But please note, you can't throw away your books and say, hurrah, no more school. Having studied the books and learnt everything which can be learnt out of the books and mastered them thoroughly, then put aside the books. Because after that, it is only the book of life from which you read and learn. And the learning is the discipline. And that learning which is discipline is your flowering and fruition. One other thing. In the Katha Upanishad, he who has understanding, who is mindful and ever pure, reaches the goal from which he is born no more. He who is mindful and ever pure. So I think on that note, we'll stop today.